Welcome back to the Training Babble Podcast. I'm your host, Dave Schell, and we're back for another Fast Physiology with Phil Batterson. Phil, thanks for coming back again.
Of course, happy to be here.
All right, so if you are not caught up, we are doing a series of short, focused podcasts on different aspects of physiology. And so you can go back and look at all those. Some of the things we've touched on so far is sweet spot training, training principles. I can't remember the other one that we
zone two training.
Zone two, yes. Endurance training. I'm going to call it endurance.
yeah, I know. It's always fun when you start to talk and dive into different avenues and communities and how they actually prescribe and describe different styles of training. Yeah. It's something that I'm still learning the vernacular coming out of the research world. I'm very steeped in the research vernacular, and now I'm trying to get up to date with all of the different coaching vernacular as well.
I mean, it's such a good point. And it's like, I mean, I went to a few coaching certifications and stuff, and it's super confusing because people use different names. And I think part of it is like coaches will come up with names so that they can have like a proprietary zone system or something, you know? And it's like, it just makes it super confusing for athletes. Which is a perfect segue to what we're going to talk about today. And so today we are talking about, and maybe I'll misspeak here, but I think these are all the same thing, but we're just, it keeps coming up with different names. So today we're going to talk about VLA max, which I think is the same as anaerobic capacity or glycolytic capacity or functional reserve capacity or W prime. And I think at one point it was anaerobic work capacity too. So I guess let's start there. Am I right in thinking that those all describe essentially the same phenomenon?
So yeah, yes and no. I would say things like VLA max, which is the maximal rate of lactate production into the blood that is measured before and after a sprint, for example, is a rate. So that is trying to quantify how much glycolysis or how much carbohydrate breakdown your body can undergo at a certain amount of time. So think of it as like how fast can your engine rev, something like that. Then anaerobic work capacity, W prime. Would you say functional reserve capacity? See, again, this is exactly like, this is why I love kind of, you know, like this new challenge of trying to figure out all the different vernacular. It's so all of those capacities are essentially how big is that tank when you're over revving super fast.
Right. It's work above threshold or critical power. It's a finite amount of work above critical power, which can be to an extent calculated. If you knew people's numbers, you could say, okay, you could do X amount of watts for this many seconds or this X amount of watts for this many seconds.
Yep. Exactly. So I was doing a little bit of homework before this podcast, and good. I was listening to Fast Talk Labs, and I think is it Sebastian Weber?
Yeah.
He's kind of the guy that's really pushed VLA max, and his the talk is that the definition of VLA max is like that is a rate, or if you have a jar for your anaerobic system, then it is the opening of that jar.
How
much could you pour out? Yeah. How big is that hole? How much could you pour out at one point? The jar size is like your W prime or your anaerobic work capacity or your functional reserve capacity. Yeah. So you have both the size of the mouth of the jar and how big the jar is. And that's going to play into your anaerobic work capacity total, in a sense. So they're kind of the same, but they're slightly different.
Okay. So this is great because I think it sounds like we'll get into two different things here, but either way, my question is to either of those, when does it matter and why does it matter?
Oh yeah. So that is a really good question and I think it's context specific. So I think for most individuals, especially ones like that you're training that are going to do 4, 6, 8 hour mountain biking races. Maximal rate of lactate production into the blood, VLA max, probably not too important.
Right.
Like overall, you're going to be working out or you're going to be exercising so far below your second threshold or functional threshold power or LT2 or VT2 or whatever you want to call that, that you really should never be dipping into that anaerobic work capacity. Obviously, or actually, so I'm putting my foot in my mouth here. If you're doing mountain biking races and there's very punchy things, you know, right, where you're going up, you're going down, you're accelerating, you're decelerating, you're doing all those sort of things, then it's going to matter. But I don't think it's going to, I don't think that the rate at which you're breaking down carbohydrates matters. I think how big that jar is what kind of matters.
Well, right. And what I'll say to this, and this has been my experience, and based on, like you just said, like, so for the majority of athletes that I coach and the type of events they're doing, rarely is it a limiter.
Right.
And you really just need enough. And I think it's more, you have to be prepared. So in one of the podcasts we did, we talked about muscles cramping. And so I'm always a fan of, like, you have to prepare the muscles for the demand of the event. And so mountain bike races can be very punchy. And so you need to be prepared to, like, be very stochastic or variable. Mm-hmm. But unless it, like, the times, and you can correct me if I'm wrong here, like, for the majority of athletes I coach, like, the only time it might be a focus is if they're doing a cross country mountain bike race and the start is really important, which means that they're going to have like a very, very hard 1 minute start straight into, like, to get the whole shot or whatever. And so then it's like, that would be a focus. But for most athletes that are doing like marathon and stuff, it's like, you need enough, you need, like, you need to be able to access it, but it's typically not going to be a limiter for a 6 hour event.
Yeah. I think the way that I've kind of been thinking about this a little bit more and more is, and well, so first of all, the way that it's described is that you have VLA max, which describes your glycolytic capacity. And then you have VO2 max, which describes your aerobic capacity.
Right.
And these two are kind of always at odds with each other, right? You can't really improve one and improve the other at the same time. So if you have a high VLA max, you might have a little bit lower of a VO2 max. That's what's been described. But I think what gets lost in those conversations is that this is in elite level athletes who are maximizing everything already. Because I've had times personally where I've increased my VO2 max and my sprint capacity both at the same time. But if you think about those conversations, you would kind of leave them with being like, oh, well, I probably shouldn't be able to increase both of those at the same time. That was most likely because I was a more naive athlete. So really anything that I was going to do was going to expand both my ability to contract harder using more carbohydrate and go longer using, you know, more of like the aerobic means of energy creation or energy synthesis. So, but what I think is actually happening is if you're doing specific training, then VLA max is going to just be a product of whatever training you're doing.
Right.
Right. Right. That's kind of the point. So if you're doing specific training for like a super punchy, you know, like 1 minute all out, maybe your VLA max is going to be a little bit higher. If you eat a little bit more carbohydrate on a given day, maybe your VLA max is going to be a little bit higher. If you decide to go completely fat adapted, your VLA max is absolutely going to be lower. So there's all these variables that kind of play into it. And I just think, as opposed to focusing on changing, say, VLA max up or down or one way or the other, you can get a pretty good idea of how well someone's going to tolerate a sprint by having them do sprints, especially before or after, you know, like a 2 hour race or something along those lines. Right.
No, not like that was my thought as I was preparing for this too, and reading up more on the VLA Max stuff is like, I think so. Part of it is like it's this like black box thing. So it came from inside, right? They have an algorithm and stuff like that, and so and maybe there's other ways to calculate it too, or like through actual lactate testing. But it's
I
like,
was gonna say the way that I haven't read any papers that have actually talked about the methodology, but the way I think it's actually measured is you take a lactate measurement before, and then you do a 20-second sprint, and then you measure lactate periodically afterwards. And okay. You say, okay, well, what was the maximal rise in lactate? But the challenge is that that's going to be dependent on power output that you're able to actually output, the length of that sprint, and a number of different factors. And I think from a definition standpoint, I am a little bit wary that it's truly, because the true definition, or the definition that they use, is maximal rate of glycolysis or lactate production occurring in the muscle. And that's not the case.
Right.
Lactate from your blood does not give us how much production of lactate we have at the muscle. It is the product of how much is being produced and how much is being uptaken. So you could be producing a shitload of lactate, but if you have really, really robust mitochondrial populations, then you're not going to be allowing that to leak out into the blood.
Right.
So from that perspective, you're going to actually have a lower VLA max. I'm being nitpicky here because I think that the way we describe it just has to change just ever so slightly, because then it opens up the conversation to say, well, you know, like perhaps a marathon runner who has a VLA max of 0.3 actually does have a pretty high capacity to utilize carbohydrates and glucose, especially if they're setting like the world record in the marathon. They just have a low VLA max because they have super robust mitochondrial populations that are then going to be able to use that lactate or that pyruvate that's being created. So then it's not getting into the blood.
And so I agree with you on that. Like that it is, I feel like there's a little bit of like black magic or smoke and mirrors going on there, but and it goes back to what we were saying when we were like, sometimes people come up with things because it's a way to market something or whatever. But that's been also like always been my kind of feeling on it, is like, if I wanted to know what somebody can do, and this is a little bit different because you're talking about rate, but as far as capacity, if I want to know what somebody can do for 30 seconds or 60 seconds or 20 seconds, then I'll just have them go do that thing for 30 seconds and that will become their capacity. Right. And so like, do we really need like these things to tell us what the capacity is for 90 seconds or what have you? I just want to go back to when you're talking about VLA max and VO2 max, and how, like when you're talking about it, I always picture like a yin yang, you know, where it's like these two equal portions, and if one's going to get bigger, the other has to get smaller naturally.
Right. Cause your circle is the same size.
Right. Well,
conceivably your circle is the same size.
Right. And so I guess I've heard it explained too in this, cause I've always thought of it the same way, is like, it's kind of a teeter totter. If one side goes up, the other side has to go down, or vice versa. But if we talk about it with like muscle fiber distribution, and you have 100% muscle fibers, only 50%, whatever percent is like slow twitch, only the remainder can be fast twitch. Right. And so as you change those, like you can never have more than 100% muscle fiber.
Right.
But I think with the example you were giving with like sprint and stuff like that, I think in my mind, again, I'm not a physiologist, but it's like, based on my experience, I could see that happening, because a lot of times like strength gains are just motor recruitment, like telling your brain to recruit bigger motor units. And so without an increase in lean muscle mass, or like really physiology, it's just more of a neuromuscular recruitment sort of thing that could see that peak power going up without changing physiology necessarily.
I mean, it's changing your physiology. It's just not at the level of like the single muscle fiber, right? It's at the muscle, or it's at the level of the neuromuscular level, which is different. And that's why I think we have to really address the context that we're trying to measure and quantify this before we start to put in the content to either change it or do other things like that. I will say, I do think that, you know, like some level of trying to measure, like say glycolytic capacity or non-aerobic work capacity or something like that is valuable, because it gives people maybe a metric to kind of work off of and be like, okay, well, I can only do a certain amount of work above my critical power. So I have to be careful not to burn that candle too fast, whether that's, you know, saying like, okay, well, you're going to go out, we know your FTP, or, you know, your maintainable power for the 6 hour race is like 250 watts, but I want you to hit 350 for the first minute. Don't go higher than 350, because we know that if you go, you know, if you go higher than 350 for longer than a minute, then you're going to be kind of SOL. So it gives you a way of kind of getting an idea of what, what that capacity is before fatigue, in a sense, because if you do go over that, then the amount of time it actually takes and the amount of decrease in wattage it takes to get rid of, you know, those metabolite buildups that are going to be causing fatigue is so much longer than if you just didn't ever go over it in the first place. So it is valuable from that perspective. But
in that case, we're talking about the capacity again. We're not talking about the rate. And so that's like, I was going to come back to that, is like, so like, we still haven't really made a case for like, why do we care what the glycolytic rate is?
I think it's sports specific. I think for most of us who are doing long races, like 2, 3, 4, 5 hours, I think that it's just going to be a product of whatever training you're doing. It is what it is. I don't think it's not going to be the difference between, you know, you finishing 100 miles in Leadville in 8 hours or 10 hours. Like, it's not that much of a difference. It's more like probably 8 hours and 15 minutes or 8 hours and 20 minutes, maybe.
Right.
And that's, and it might even be less. But yeah, it's, I don't know. I've been trying, because in the research world, I hadn't heard of this until, you know, fairly recently. And I still am trying to wrap my mind around who it would be good for. It would be absolutely good for people like sprinters and track cyclists, I think. You know, having that ability. Huh?
BMX.
Where, yeah, yeah.
It's a standing start. It's like, yeah, so it's like very explosive. Mm-hmm. Like 30 seconds means the difference between winning and losing,
yeah,
in those cases, you know?
Right. But something I will say is that, you know, so even when you do sports specific training, right, it's like, say for example, you started with 50% type 1 fibers and then you had 40% type 2A and 10% type 2X fibers. One of the really interesting things is that you can train those type 2A fibers to be more like slow twitch fibers or more like fast twitch fibers, depending on what you're doing. But what we also have to remind ourselves of is that even if we as endurance athletes were to do sprints on a bike, like all out sprints on a bike, or do a lot of anaerobic threshold training, or like training just above VO2 max, we're still only operating at 40 to 60% of maximal contractile speed or force production. So that's still going to shift or make our phenotype more aerobic, mm-hmm, in a sense of like, it's going to be more stimulatory towards the endurance side of things. Rather, if you were doing like strength stuff, like one rep max or Olympic powerlifting, where it's like as much power as you possibly can to try to get the bar to your shoulders or above your head. So we have to remind ourselves that in the realm of endurance, even when we are going pretty hard, like VO2 max stuff, that's still very, very low in terms of our overall muscles' ability to, contract. And it's still going to result in more aerobic phenotype adaptations rather than that anaerobic phenotype adaptations. So I would be interested to see more studies. So if people do have studies and stuff from, you know, like the VLA max, where it's like, oh, well, these individuals started with a VLA max of this, and then we did a bunch of sprint training, and then they wound up with this, and it was increased. I would absolutely like to see that. I want to know how much it can increase and how much influence I actually have over it based on different interventions. Because again, it's like, I was just reading a paper that was on the Inside website today, and it was from like 2022. And there's only like four, maybe five papers that apparently mention VLA max, which in the grand scheme of things, that's like a drop in the bucket compared to things like VO2 max.
Right.
So that I still think there's just like a lot of questions, and there's a lot of people who are just really leaning on this value to be like, oh, well, you know, like we gotta decrease your VLA max so we can increase your VO2 max. And it's like, or if you just increase their VO2 max and did more riding, would that just result in a lower VLA max? Not because you're actually lowering VLA max, right?
Well, and at the risk of going over a little bit here, that's kind of my feeling of it too, because I've also read some of the papers, and they give kind of like a flow chart. Like, mm-hmm. if you're trying to decrease VLA max, do this. And so it's a lot of sweet spot and low carbohydrate availability. If you're trying to increase it, do this. And so where my mind goes with that is like, I'm always trying to train an athlete for the demands of the event. And so I would do that naturally anyway, based on what they like. So if I had a more fast twitch oriented athlete, mm-hmm. that had really high like peak power and like 30, 60 second power and stuff like that, but they're doing endurance events, well, we're not going to be working on sprints and like anaerobic capacity or whatever we want to call it. Anyway, we're going to be working on endurance, and sweet spot or tempo is going to be race pace. And so we'd mm-hmm. be doing that anyway. You know what I mean? And so,
yeah, well, there was a study that came out that was looking at elite level CrossFitters, and any variable that correlated with these elite level CrossFitter performances. And the only variable that was predictive or correlated with CrossFitter performance was percent body fat percentage. And the case that the authors were making, and I think this is an inappropriate case, was that lower body fat percentage resulted in better performance. So I think
causation versus correlation.
Exactly. So I think what may be happening here, and again, I don't, so this is just me thinking out loud, and I don't know the whole story behind VLA max and other things like that. I don't know all the literature behind it, but I think one of the things is that there is potentially a correlation with VLA max and your sprint capacity, and then, you know, VO2 max, and it's inversely correlated to VO2 max. But then when you artificially lower it, are you going to see an automatic increase in VO2 max, right? So for example, if I had an athlete and then for some reason they just had a super, super high VLA max, I guarantee you I could reduce their VLA max to essentially zero by just putting them on a high fat diet for a week.
Yeah.
They would have hardly any sprint capacity. They wouldn't be able to oxidize carbohydrates because they don't have any on them, but that's not going to translate automatically to an increased VO2 max.
Right.
Like, I can almost guarantee you that, because they're still going to be carbohydrate depleted, and VO2 max is partially dependent on carbohydrate. So I think that, you know, it's like, oh, to reduce VLA max, what do you have to do? You have to use more carbohydrates by doing sweet spot training and zone two training. You have to increase your VO2 max, which is then going to, again, use more carbohydrates, or allow for that pyruvate that's being made to be uptaken into the mitochondria more efficiently and more effectively, thus reducing VLA max. So I think it's kind of a chicken or the egg sort of situation, where VLA max is the egg, and the chicken is the exercises that you're doing in order to actually change how big that egg is and what it looks like.
Yeah.
And if so, that made any sense.
I was thinking the same thing before, where I think it just becomes this thing where it's like, I mean, just like you brought up the CrossFit thing, right? It's like, yeah, just because things are correlated doesn't mean that they're positive. And so,
right. Because reading that paper, you'd be like, oh, well, if I get down to 1% body fat, I'll be the best CrossFitter in the world. It's like, right. No, you won't. Like, it's just, they just happen to work out so much that they have low body fat percentage.
Right. Yeah. So what are your takeaways for this episode?
Yeah. So I think my biggest takeaways are that in order to, it's what we just talked about on the last episode on here, is in order to be good at the sport that you're doing, you have to specifically engage in the sport that you're doing. And through engaging in that sport, especially with those longer, you know, so if you're a half Ironman, Ironman triathlete, if you're doing longer mountain bike races and other things like that, then that is going to result in a reduction in your VLA max, potentially reduce your anaerobic work capacity and other things like that, rather than the other way around. And I think there's a lot of other things that are much more important to focus on, like the training principles, like what you're doing and other things like that, rather than trying to manipulate that, you know, just one physiological variable in order to kind of hack your performance. So yeah, that's what I would take away. It's still challenging, because I do think there is some level of usefulness for anaerobic work capacity, especially if, you know, from a sport specific point of view, if you have a super hard sprint that you have to do, or you want to be able to sprint at the end of like a 6-hour race, then that's nice to know. Cause then you can kind of get an idea of like, okay, well, how long can I sprint for and at what power? Yep. But yeah, other than that, I think it's I don't think it's going to be the difference between, you know, great performances and elite performances. I think there's a lot of other things we can focus on.
Yeah, I think those are all good points. And I think my big takeaway here, and this is my opportunity to throw some shade, is never pass up an opportunity. I think it's kind of twofold here. Is one, just because we can measure something doesn't mean we should.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that happens a lot of times with all these wearables and stuff like there's just so many devices out there, and it's like, we can track everything, but a lot of it doesn't like lead to increased performance or anything. And so it just adds to the noise. And then my second one is, and I see this a lot with the 3-letter acronyms, is we should not, like, yes, we want to work on all aspects of fitness over the course of a season, but our goal shouldn't be for everything to go up. And the reason I say that is I have a lot of athletes that I work with, and it's like, oh, I want this to go up. And like, so if I'm like speaking in very general terms, so like we track like 5-second power, 60-second power, 5-minute power, 20-minute power, and like 3-hour power. And the reason why is because those are kind of proxies for sprint power, anaerobic capacity, VO2 max, and threshold.
Mm-hmm.
And so my thing is, we don't necessarily want them all to go up. It really depends on what you're training for and what we're tracking. And so I think as soon as people see a measure, like we want everything to go up, but I don't think it always matters, and it's not going to lead to increased performance. And mm-hmm. one of my favorite, I think it's an economist who said it, but it's like, once a measure becomes a target, it ceases to be a good measure. So that's my,
I like that.
2 cents.
I like that. I've played with the ideas of like, you know, what are the physiological variables that we do want to see increase. And I think this will be a good topic to talk about, because it is sport specific. Right. And I could give you examples right now, but I will hold off on giving those examples until the next episode.
A cliffhanger.
Yep.
Awesome. Well, I think this is a great episode. Thanks again for your time, and looking forward to the next one.
Yeah, of course, me too.
Okay.